this has been re-traumatizing for our kids. Many of them are being reminded that while the world is pausing, while people are being asked to stay home, they don't have that. Uno, dos, tres.
Hey, welcome to In the Thick. This is a podcast about politics, race, and culture from a POC perspective. I'm Maria Hinojosa.
And I'm Julio Ricardo Varela.
And I am so, so glad to be having this conversation today with two really fabulous guests. They are here in New York City, but because of the quarantine, they're recording themselves, each from their home base. Joining us for the first time, Alex Roque. He is the executive director of the Ali Forney Center, which is a beautiful nonprofit in New York City that provides shelter and support for LGBTQ youth. You guys have 18 sites throughout the city. One of them is right next to our studio in Harlem on 125 that one day we will see each other there again. Hi, Alex, and welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Also joining us is ITT All-Star Imara Jones. She's an award-winning journalist and creator of Translash Media, a media platform that tells trans stories to save trans lives. Imara, I want to hug you.
I know, but you can't.
Girl, you can't.
And I can't, but I really, really, really want to hug you.
But I appreciate that. Thank you. Same here.
Miss you so much.
Miss you too.
Yeah, it's good to have you back.
So we're going to be talking about the impact that coronavirus is having on LGBTQ youth of color in New York City. But before we get into that, we really want to do like a temperature check. And if you're new to our show, this is where we do like an emotional, spiritual temperature check with our guests, because both of you are really deep into these communities. So I just want to know, how are you holding up at this moment, Imara? What's your temperature check?
I think like everyone, it comes and goes now. For me, the first 2 weeks of the crisis were the most intense because everything was changing so rapidly around March 14th or whatever it was, 16th.
Right.
And, you know, in those first 2 weeks, I either know personally or have friends who lost someone. That was around six people. Wow. That was really hard. That's when it felt like everything was falling apart. And then we just have stabilized at this really high level of death, unfortunately. And, you know, human beings are miraculous in the ability to get used to things that are excruciating. And I feel like I'm getting in that point, oddly. Like it just now is becoming, you know, we're at this high level, it's intense, and we're just there. And the disease seems to be shifting rather than abating heavily. And that's concerning.
Yeah. Recognizing all of that.
Yeah.
Alex, how are you doing? Like, how are you managing? What's your personal way of coping right now? How are you feeling?
You know, I have a debilitating superpower of just incredible optimism.
Hell yes.
Woo! Love it.
Bravo. We want that. Yeah, bring it.
Yeah. And sometimes it might be naive optimism, but you know, every morning I wake up and it's a question of checking the email, checking text messages. Are we stable today?
Yeah.
And within an hour of that cycle, I'm like, I can say we're stable today. You know, I have a very unique job. I get to see, in spite of how dark things are, I get to see how much light and love there is in the world, regardless of what's happening, right? Like, you know, I'm working with kids whose parents have rejected them, have denied them love, have denied them humanity. And I get to work with the other side where it's people who want to help, who want to tell our story, who want to connect, who want to just make things better. So I get some of that love and energy. So I'm stable today and feeling lots of love and energy. And that's my temperature today.
Oh my God.
It might change tomorrow.
Thank you.
Oh,
love it. Well, let's go with that right now.
Yeah.
So one of the things that we witnessed during those of us who lived through the AIDS crisis in New York City is that, you know, particularly LGBTQ youth of color, they created houses that, you know, performed in all the clubs like La Escuelita. And so there was one thing that happened was that family was created.
Right.
But the truth is, and you know these statistics, right, is that a lot of these kids of color who are part of the community, they are rejected by their parents, so they end up homeless. A 2018 survey of young adults who were experiencing homelessness in New York City found that nearly 200 homeless LGBTQ youth who responded to the survey, 44% of them identified as Black, 26% as Latinx, 16% as mixed race.
Wow.
So why are young LGBTQ people of color affected so much by homelessness? And what happens when you throw a pandemic on top of that? Alex.
what we find in disparities is communities of color experience greater disparities. LGBT communities experience greater disparities. And even within the LGBT community, our young people are still on the outskirts of the outskirts, right?
Yeah.
You know, our young people are largely at the intersection of being people of color, of being brought up in communities that are underserved and undercared for by our systems, and then are rejected by their families. And what we're seeing is that this has been re-traumatizing for our kids. You know, many of them are being reminded that while the world is pausing, while people are being asked to stay home, they don't have that.
Right.
You know, it's almost like the holidays. In the holidays, our kids are reminded more than anything of their homelessness. They're reminded more than anything of their family rejection, of how little they have and how much has been taken from them because of their identity, because that's when people come together. Hmm. And this pandemic is really a time of families coming together. And it's a great burden on our young people.
Amara, what have you seen in your work?
For me, one of the things that I've seen, it touches upon what Alex mentioned, is this ideal, this reaction of resilience. As someone who spoke to me the other day, a trans activist, Cecilia Gentile, said to me, you know, I feel like my entire life as a trans person is in crisis.
Whoa.
And so consequently, I feel like I have the tools to be able to respond to this moment.
Uh-huh.
Right.
Wow.
I did a show a couple of weeks ago on the trans response to COVID-19. We had India Moore and a whole bunch of other people on it. And it focused on the rash of mutual aid programs that trans people created. I mean, within the first week of the crisis, I saw mutual aid programs to help people buy food. That's what India Moore did. There was programs that responded to food insecurity amongst trans people called the Okra Project. AVP upped and issued guidance that week for people who were experiencing an uptick in domestic and intimate partner violence, which has occurred during this crisis for people.
Right.
And on and on and on and on it went. And so at the end of the show, I was super hopeful. It was the most hopeful I've been throughout the entire crisis. And it was because marginalized people, the most marginalized of the marginalized, as Alex said, knew what was needed and responded well before any other group of people that I could think of.
Right.
And it serves as a model. One of the reasons why I wanted to spotlight those is because that's what everybody needs to be doing. That's what everybody needs to be thinking about.
Exactly.
Yeah, yeah.
And the fact that, again, you know, the most marginalized of the marginalized figured out what to do and begin to organize and deliver help to other people who are in even more need, I think, is where all of us need to be.
Preach. Absolutely.
Yeah. Thank you so much for sharing all that. One question I have during all this, right, is how communities in general, right, are grappling with homelessness during a pandemic. I mean, you think about having this place to sleep every night, being able to shower or wash your hands or disinfect your space, right? The privilege of being able to do that is pretty clear. So our producer, Harsha Nahata, she talked with local shelters in New York City, and they said this, that while they're trying their best to keep services up, they've taken a hit. Some have had to reduce drop-in services, for example, or stop taking new clients for sheltering because of social distancing guidelines, right? So shelters like the Trinity Place, where everyone stays in the same room, they've stopped new intake. They have to be strict about who goes in and out. And this is because, you know, if one person gets sick, everyone might get sick. Wendy Kaplan, she directs services at Trinity Place, and she described it like this.
Our residents have lost their jobs in the wake of this pandemic. So we're paying for phone bills. We're actually sending out laundry. So our residents don't have to go to the laundromat where it's very hard to social distance. And we're bringing in all food and supplies. So folks don't need to go to the grocery store. And we're bringing in food so they can eat three meals a day.
So in other centers, right, rooms that would house youth have reduced capacity to keep in line with social distancing guidelines. So Alex, I want to start with you. How are you all navigating this, and how is this affecting whether youth can get the services they need?
You know, it's so unprecedented and uncharted for everyone, and we're no exception to that, right? It's this struggle of understanding that there's so many homeless young people on our streets and understanding that we are as Imaro mentioned, you know, we've stuck together. We've created our services together. We are our community together. And now to be told you can't be together is problematic. So we've had to get creative with what that looks like and how to restructure services and also how to advocate so that there are other services, so that the systems that are supposed to help these young people, that are supposed to protect these young people, are more responsive during this time. And, you know, I'm happy to share that. We are developing, you know, a hotel model where we can have young people who are coming in off the streets to provide respite from the streets, where it's more isolated. So it's really put a burden on an already overstrained system that really is punctuating how bad things were and how close we were to doom for not having the right care processes in place.
Right. And there's this whole other thing that people aren't, when you're talking about trans youth, for example, there's a whole lack of access to gender affirming, just, you know, for example, medical providers, people who are trans friendly and experienced in healthcare.
Right.
A Vox article said, quote, "While there's no evidence that COVID-19 disproportionately affects trans people, America's economic and healthcare systems often marginalize the trans community. In other words, the coronavirus itself isn't transphobic, but the United States is." I'm just going to add the word structurally. So when it comes to healthcare, 13% of trans people don't have health insurance. Transgender adults in the US are also more at risk for health issues like asthma, diabetes, heart disease, or HIV. And that's according to the National Center for Transgender Equality. Now, all of these can be devastating in a global public health pandemic like what we're living through now.
Right.
But then you think about the fact that, you know, many in the trans community might not hold formal jobs because they've been shut out because of transphobia. If you rely on sex work or other unofficial economies, a lot of these people are losing their primary sources of income. This is where I just begin to just get really worried. Although you guys are making me feel much more hopeful.
I know.
And this is the beauty of communities that have been attacked since forever. And so they are, you know, hunkering down on supporting each other.
Right.
The workers who aren't eligible to receive these federal relief funds, like small business loans, because, for example, their industries aren't legal. So, Imaro, you've been doing this whole series, Lives at Stake, which is really, you're looking at it through your organization, Trans/Media, and you've recently been talking about the economic impact on the pandemic for sex workers.
Sex work is a vital lifeline and source of income for trans people. Now, people engage in sex work not only because of economic and educational marginalization, but also for some, it gives a sense of empowerment and control over how they earn. But with coronavirus and specifically lockdowns and social distancing, that vital lifeline is cut. And compounding the problem is the fact that government aid, because of criminalization, is not available to trans sex workers and sex workers overall, meaning that the government programs that are keeping people afloat aren't available.
Thank you for your work with Trans/Media. You're doing these community check-ins related to the coronavirus outbreak. So what are you hearing? What are you hearing on the ground? How are trans youth in particular? What are they saying to you in terms of, like, for example, the specificity of the economic challenges during these times?
Yeah, thank you for that. And thank you for recognizing the work of Lives at Stake, which is also co-produced with the WNYC's The Green Space, I should say.
Nice.
Well, let's go back to specifically your question and your reference to sex work, which I think is really important because it's emblematic of the economic distress, which you referenced overall. You know, 1 out of 10 trans people have engaged in sex work for all of the reasons that you mentioned, transphobia and being shut out. And then for women of color, that is high as 4 out of 10. So we're talking about an incredible, important source of income that, as you say, is a part of the informal economy that is all of a sudden severed. And compounding the issue is that because sex work is illegal, and you can extend this even if you are doing legal work and are undocumented, for example, or if you are doing legal work and a citizen and are married to someone who's undocumented, you're not able to receive these benefits that the government is using to keep people afloat. And so people are in very, very desperate circumstances. Lorena Borjas, who is an activist, who is a trans Latina, who is a former sex worker, created a fund several weeks ago designed for this community, and she died of COVID-19 a week afterwards. And that fund is designed to bridge these gaps. And so as someone mentioned to me the other day, when she was hearing that people needed to pay rent, et cetera, freaked out because she said, how are we going to raise that amount of money for this number of people? And then people replied to her, no, these women need $200 to pay their room. That's how much they rent it for a month. They need $50 for groceries this week. And so the needs, when you think about them, for most people don't sound extreme, but if you don't have $50, if you don't have $200, that could mean that you go without food and that you're homeless right away. Mm-hmm. And so the response so far has been, again, the creation of these mutual aid programs within community to be able to support people during this dire need. But the longer this goes on, we need to figure out ways to institutionalize that. And that's where the government needs to be.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, Amara. I'm not holding my breath that this administration will recognize the needs of this community, but I appreciate your optimism.
Well, I think Alex is the optimist.
Yeah, I want to hear what Alex has to say about all this.
Just really briefly to that, I'm even thinking about our city government, right? I think that our city government, I mean, you know, if you think about, for example, just last week began to say, oh my God, we need to feed everybody. How are we going to do that? You know, 3 or 4 weeks in, I'm thinking more locally. And even though we have the politics locally to be able to respond, they're not there yet.
Yeah.
Alex, what about you?
It's our responsibility to yell loud and proud at the systems that are supposed to protect us, right? And especially those who are most vulnerable within our communities, with optimism, but not holding our breaths. But also, I think that we have to galvanize our community locally. We have to prioritize and signal out who needs to be prioritized within our community. And it's something that we've done at Ollie Fornes, certainly immediately. Our priority number one was isolation, sanitation, and cleaning and caring. And then number two was, how are we providing for our transgender services, our TGNC services, our TGNC housing sites? Right. What are we doing in terms of lost income? What support services are we offering? But I think we all have that responsibility, not just, you know, a homeless youth provider. I think that all of us who are in a stable position have to look at who among us needs the most support, or who among us is most disconnected from support.
So our producer, Harsha, she also talked to Kate Barnhart, who's the executive director of New Alternatives for LGBTQ Homeless Youth in New York City. And this is what Kate had to say.
Many of our young people have been laid off or furloughed or can't find a job because so many things are closed. But then I have had other young people who have been able to obtain jobs. But then when I say to them, so what's your new job? Well, one was a dietary aid at NYU Hospital, and one was delivering for Amazon. I'm excited for them, and I know they're happy to have jobs, but those are both very high-risk things in terms of occupational exposure. And, I mean, I'm quite sure that if doctors and nurses are not getting protective equipment, the people handing out meals probably really aren't. So that's definitely a concern.
But like you said, Amara and Alex, there's a lot of people that are stepping up. You've mentioned mutual aid efforts, and it's not just in New York City. It's popping up all over the country. And some have specifically raised funds, right, for sex workers or LGBTQ folks who have been impacted. Let me just give you one example. After college dorms kicked students out in early March, there was a lot of local organizations and people in different cities that started organizing to house students who could not return home, either for like safety reasons or financial reasons. So we know that the federal government, right, like, surprise, surprise, newsflash, they have historically failed these communities. And we know that this administration, come on, I mean, they've continued to take away protections from trans people. So, Alex, I know we started talking about community organizations. Can you share more specifically in your space how they are stepping in to provide support and essentially becoming the role of government?
Yeah, I mean, just, you know, just this morning, I received an email from a 17-year-old trans woman who said, I'm privileged. I had access to my family and they were accepting and I was able to transition, and I'm reading about your care and I want to make masks, and I'm getting my friends together to make masks for the young people in your care. We've had a number of individuals understand that technology was a way of connection, of humanity, of connecting our young people to education, to services, to mental health care, and started donating laptops. Our council member in South Slope, Carlos Menchaca, who largely serves an immigrant community, donated 42 laptops to all the clients we have in South Slope and also weekly grocery deliveries for those clients. There's been an outpour of just ways to be creative. And I keep saying this, you know, people have found ways to work from home, people have found ways to learn from home, and now are being called upon to help from home.
Yeah.
And there's so much that you can do. We have a pen pal program, we have a check-in chat with the young people, we have tutoring and mentoring taking place remotely through volunteers. And it's really a time, like, I think New Yorkers and I think communities who've been strained know what it's like to rejoice in awful times and what it's like to find a pathway towards safety and care and community. And I think that's what we're seeing. And I'm just grateful for it.
Nice.
Which is why when you have this other thing that happens, it's so depressing because on Thursday, April 23rd, there was this news, very devastating news coming out of Puerto Rico. Two transgender women were killed. Activists say that two bodies were found inside a charred car in southeast Puerto Rico, making four such deaths in the past 2 months. The women were identified as 21-year-old Laila Palais and 32-year-old Serena Angelique Velasquez Ramos. So in the 2015 U.S. transgender survey, 46% of the respondents said that they have been verbally harassed. 9% were physically attacked because of being transgender. 1 in 10 who were out to immediate family members reported that a family member was violent towards them because they were transgender. And we know that specifically Black transgender women experience a disproportionate amount of violence. So, Imara, how do we recognize that violence has been a part of this community? As you say, it has been attacked since forever. So how do you find a safe space and protection right now?
Yeah, there is a real worry about that. And I think that one of the answers is technology. There is a trans youth who created a platform to do just that, to connect people who are trapped at home, whose parents may not be aware of their gender identity, but who want to have a lifeline to other people with whom they can talk and have relationships with outside of the ones that they have in their families. So I think that there are emerging answers, but I think that those are really difficult circumstances. And it is why you're seeing an increase in domestic and intimate partner violence and a concern about that for people who are trapped in these circumstances, as you mentioned, and don't have outlets.
Obviously, we're hearing, I mean, what's happening in Puerto Rico or everywhere with the trans community, the violence is just, we got to keep speaking out. And there's this emotional and psychological toll, especially for youth who are having to shelter in place in homes, right? They don't feel accepting of their identity. Like you said, Imara, how do you cope with that? So at the beginning of April, the Trevor Project, which is a national LGBTQ youth rights organization, they released a report about the impact of COVID-19 on mental health and suicide prevention among LGBTQ youth. They found that the number of youth reaching out to their crisis service programs has more than doubled since the pandemic began. And the CEO of the Trevor Project, Amit Paley, explained this recently on MSNBC, how this pandemic makes LGBTQ youth even more vulnerable.
There are more than 1.8 million LGBTQ youth every single year. This is pre this pandemic, that seriously consider suicide every year. And a lot of the places that some of that tension comes from is being rejected from society and from their families. For a lot of LGBTQ young people, the main sources of support that they get are at their schools, at clubs, at community centers, at physical spaces that they no longer have access to. And so being isolated with your family, some of whom may be rejecting of your very identity, not giving you the source of support that you need, and not being able to connect with some of those really important positive influences in your life, can be extremely challenging for LGBTQ youth right now.
Alex, at the Ali Forney Center, you put out information about how COVID-19 was affecting youth in New York City. Nearly 90% of the youth seeking your services say that family rejection is the reason they were experiencing homelessness. And Alex, when you spoke with our producer, Harsha, you told her that you've seen youth become newly homeless during this pandemic. So, Alex, can you explain this? Like, what is the impact of not having that support at this really scary time?
so many things have, you know, taken a little turn for the better in spite of the darkness. I had hoped that there would be a pause to homophobia and transphobia, but it's actually been the opposite, right?
Yeah.
And the impact of not having services, the impact of not having care, the impact of not having a family, actually, it's incredibly traumatizing. It's incredibly further isolating for these young people, the toll on the mental health. You know, imagine, you know, your parents kicking you out because of who you are, and then being in this time, and realizing that you don't have anyone. So there's been an increased toll for our young people. However, there is data that we're working on right now that's indicating that young people who, regardless of being homeless, actually have better indicators in mental health if they have affirming environments like the Ollie Forney Center and other amazing organizations who are doing great work. So there is that silver lining of, okay, you know, you're not in your homophobic, transphobic environment and you were rejected, but now you are in an affirming environment. And that's actually better for the young person is what our data is suggesting right now.
Which is why, you know, again, if we're living through such hell right now, but I really am thinking about learning lessons from the LGBTQ community from decades of resistance and survival. And I'm thinking a lot about the show Pose, which I absolutely, I mean, I love. And congratulations, Imara, on getting my, you know, personal hero, India Moore, who I just love and adore. So again, congratulations on getting them to work with you. I'm thinking about how, you know, in that moment, during the time of Pose, when I was hanging out at La Escuelita, that people were finding a way to create something that nobody was seeing. We were so off the mainstream.
Oh, work, Miss Thing! Miss Thing with the reveal! Oh, they're giving us story! They're giving us narrative! The divas are serving us Buckingham Palace high tea while the rest of you don't know nothing but lifting from the diner. I don't know of a princess or a queen who gets their clothes from Casual Corner. This is a face category, not a fashion category. If God hath given you the eyebrows of Brooke Shields, show the motherfuckers all. Stop the music, baby. Stop the music. I'm gonna need y'all to simmer down.
I just want to know, how do you see the community evolving during this pandemic? And have you in particular found one way that you're thinking about the way the community and family, chosen family, will be born out of this pandemic? So let's start with you, Alex.
Sure. You know, we find resilience in our darkest moments. Mm. I think that as people of color, as people who've been disconnected or disenfranchised or forced out or not cared for in our systems of recognizing injustices, like that's built a resilience. And I think it's also true for our young people. I mean, I see it. There's a great deal of power and fight. And I think it's part of our movement that because of what's been done to us, we are stronger. We rise up stronger. And what I see is a future full of young people who recognize that it was our community, it was our chosen families, it was our care for each other that got them through, and it's their responsibility to help others through. And, you know, if anything of the AIDS epidemic taught us over 30 years in the fight and the resilience of the people in the fight, of the scientists who were behind the research, is that in the most awful of times, in the most challenging of times, it's when you rise the strongest. And it's something that gives me great hope.
So, Imara, What are you thinking about? What's the focus for you on like something that's going to be born out of this that's kind of unexpected?
I think for now, it's actually drawing people together more tightly. I think that the mutual aid programs that we're talking about mean that people have to work together more closely. I think that some of the institutional barriers between LGBT groups is coming down because they just can't exist right now in this moment of crisis. And so it's teaching people how to better cooperate. I think that it's spotlighting more of our issues. I mean, the fact that we're having this conversation, I'm having this conversation, it's highlighting just the full range of things and bringing them to public consciousness. So I think that there will be momentum that comes out of this alongside the tragedy.
So let's move on to our final segment, which we call COVID coping.
I know it's really hard to find joy in this moment, although I have to say, Alex is definitely helping me feel more optimistic about things. And you too, Imara. There are glimmers, you know. So there's this UK dad who went on Reddit for some parenting advice because his son came home to shelter in place with his quote unquote friend. And dad suspected that there was more. You know, the dad for years had thought his son was gay, but they had never had the actual conversation. He didn't know how to talk about this. So dad reached out on Reddit to ask, and he says, "My son and his quote-unquote friend are a couple. How do I let them know it's okay?" His post goes viral, yep, and he becomes a Reddit favorite. So go, dad. And yep, it says, "Son, I love you very much. You don't have to tell me anything you don't want to, but I want you and your friend to feel comfortable about being yourselves in my house, and you don't ever need to hide anything from me. All right?" And then my son burst out laughing and said, "Oh, thank God. I reckoned you clicked on, but didn't say anything because I didn't want to make you feel weird." Basically, we've been pussyfooting around the topic because neither one of us wanted to make the other uncomfortable talking about it. All right, that was probably the wrong accent.
Wow, but, that was wrong. You are wrong.
But Imara and Alex, how are you both COVID coping during these unprecedented times? And let's start with you, Imara.
I have two things for COVID coping. One are my weekly kind of interview calls with my friends. Every Monday night, we have a quarantine. It's actually called Quarantined. And we get together and we just talk on a Zoom chat for hours, where we eat together, we drink together, we tell stories. That gets me through. And then I think all of these various DJ sets.
Ah, yes.
Right?
Yes.
I want to know your favorite DJ set so I can jump on when it's live, okay? Be sure to hit me up on Instagram with that. All right, Alex, what are you doing to COVID cope?
I am not watching the news.
Good.
Yeah, I restricted it 2 times a day and now to 1 time a day and now to almost every other day.
It's refreshing.
Yeah, I just have to stay away from it. And I am spending a lot of time making lists of what I'm grateful for and just finding gratitude in different pieces. And every day I'm able to add different things that I'm grateful for. It's kind of like a gratitude journal. And I hope to leave. I have a 5-year-old son and I hope to leave for, I hope for my son to find that in years and just focusing on that.
Go dad, go puppy.
Yeah.
Yeah. Thank you so much, Alex Roque, Executive Director at the Ali Forney Center here in New York City, and Imara Jones, creator and producer at Translash Media and an all-star here at In the Thick. Thank you so much for joining Julio and me on this very special episode of In the Thick.
Gracias. Thank you.
And all the best to you.
I'm Maria Hinojosa.
And I'm Julio Ricardo Varela.
This episode was produced by our New York Women's Foundation Ignite Fellow, Harsha Nahata. Remember, dear listener, go to Apple Podcasts to rate and review us.
5 stars.
We ask you every week because it really matters if you do it. Also, you can now listen to In the Thick on Pandora, Spotify, wherever you get your podcasts. Follow us on Twitter and on Instagram at In the Thick Show. Like us on Facebook and tell your friends and family virtually to listen. In the Thick is produced by Nicole Rothwell, Noor Saudi, and Harsha Nahata. Our audio engineers are Stephanie LeBeau, Julia Caruso, and Leah Shaw. The audio recording in New York was made by Raul Perez. Our digital editor is Luis Luna. The music you heard is courtesy of Nacional Captain ZZK Records. We'll see you, dear listener, on our next episode. Thank you again so much for listening. Gracias. Ciao.
Nos vemos. Bye.
It's Maria. ¿Cómo estás?
Hola, bien, Maria. ¿Usted?
¿Cómo de que usted?
Poniendo vieja, Maria.
Yeah, I'm just like, yo, what happened? What? I'm not your abuela, okay?
The opinions expressed by the guests and contributors in this podcast are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of Futuro Media or its employees.